That's peppy music, peppier than I feel. That's good. Very nice stuff, Mike. Thank you very much for playing it. It was at a Sarah LaDuke production. Very nice. Good stuff. It's a Yasmin Williams. It's a new-ish album. Came out in October. That's still new, right?
That's new.
And I know time is moving very fast. But, yes, still new. And it's off an album called Acadia. You can see our entire playlist online, WAMC.org. We welcome you to the proceedings this morning. It is Friday, and we have a lot to talk about. We have a wonderful group. Very thrilled to have this particular configuration in the studio. We have wonderful panelists and some great students who join us, and we always love when they can be a part of the program. And special thanks to Dr. Aaron Pasitti at Siena College for making that possible, although I know Malia has brought her students in the past, and we always look forward to it. So it's a really nice thing that we
I didn't know I could bring four at once, though.
Yeah.
I'm going to be more ambitious next time.
Yes, whatever number, like under 10. It's a little bit of a, it's not that big of a round table,
right?
But it's all right. Just remember your own comfort while deciding how many students you want to bring. Good morning, all. We welcome you. All you have to do to get in on the program is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear from you. All right, let's get to it. Chief of Staff and Vice President for Strategy and Policy at Bard College, Malia DeMont, is with us. Good morning, Malia. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well, and I just want to point out, of course, the listeners can't see this, but I'm wearing an Army shirt today. This is the Black Knights, because I'm going to be attending the West Point men's basketball team game against Marist this evening. It's a special game. Any veteran who's listening who wants to attend, it's free for all veterans. You don't need to reserve a ticket. You can just show up. The game starts at 7. It's on the campus of Marist College in Poughkeepsie.
And they're great games.
They're great games, yes.
Yeah, really.
I actually, I haven't been to a West Point men's basketball team game before, but the football... That's like that's a whole thing. Yes,
I have a good friend who just came back from one last when they I guess played Air Force, and it was just
a big one. Yeah,
yeah, big game. So very, very exciting stuff. Malia, it's always wonderful to have you here. Thank you very much. We also welcome March Gallagher, the Ulster County Controller and the former president and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley. Good morning, March. How are you?
I'm good. This week is my one-year anniversary of coming on the show. I can't believe how fast a year has gone. I feel like I was just coming for my first time on the roundtable, so I want to thank you, everybody here at the radio station, and especially the listeners for supporting the station.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks for, all of our panelists are volunteers. They come in, they give up a really good chunk of their day, depending on where they're driving from. Both Malia and March have a bit of a commute, as does Aaron, but it's the same as mine, so I'm not going to make that big of a deal of it. it is still it's wonderful that you all come here and do this for our listeners and for the audience, and we thank you very much, and it's congratulations. It's
thank
very
you.
Nice.
Yeah,
I didn't
yeah.
know anyone kept track of that. I don't think we ever did.
Roundtable anniversary.
Yeah, that's really good. I'm glad you kept track of it. I wish I said that we had the program, the computer program that kept track of such things, but we don't. We also welcome our dear friend Aaron Pasitti, who is Siena College Professor of Economics. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning, everyone. I'm doing well. It's not my one-year anniversary, and I've got no exciting news to report, so just happy to be here to clear my head.
You've been here a long time, though.
7 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was right after Trump round one got elected, so...
That's when
I've been through a lot.
So we needed you.
I know.
All right, we still do. Not only, as I mentioned, not only does Aaron teach at Siena College, but he has actual real live students, and occasionally he brings them with him to be a part of our program. I'd like to introduce them to you now. These are, for the most part, economics majors from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge course. And if that isn't completely accurate, they will let us know the asterisk next to that. But for the most part, that's the That's the program that we're talking about. And these are really smart young people who come to us and will be a vital part of the program as we move forward over the next 90 minutes or so. And any questions that you have for the students or for any of us, we would love to hear at panel@wamc.org. Casey Owens is here. Good morning, Casey. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. I'm very excited to be here. Thank you.
I'm really excited to have you here. So tell me your story.
So I'm from Saratoga Springs, so I'm actually a local.
Spot City. Go.
Yes, absolutely. I am a double major in finance and econ, and I hope to work in corporate finance someday, maybe investment banking or portfolio management.
Yeah, and that's where you make the money, right?
Exactly. Make money off of other people's money. Yeah, there you go.
Is that better than academia?
It depends. It depends in what context.
That was a loaded question.
Yeah.
Well, Casey, good morning. And what year are you in?
I'm a junior this year.
Junior. Well, great. Very nice to have you here. Jade O'Connell joins us. Hi, Jade. How are you?
Hi. Good morning.
Really nice to have you. Welcome. So tell us your story.
I'm from Poughkeepsie, New York.
All right.
I am an econ major with a minor in health studies, and I am also on the pre-law certificate track, and I hope to go into law.
Oh, what would you like to do within the confines of the law?
I want to go into medical malpractice.
Oh. Mm-hmm. I hear there's money in that, too.
Yes, there is.
Yeah.
But she's going to be on the right side of the medical malpractice.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely. As all good Siena graduates are.
Of course.
I tell this story every week when the students come in, but my dad was a graduated from Siena, so he was an alum and always a very close. I would have gone to Siena, but they didn't have a communications program, so I went to St. Rose instead. Which at the time was a really great choice, and now you're still in business and we're not. So, but you try, right? We welcome Ethan Tate to the program. Good morning, Ethan. How are you?
Hi. So happy to be here. Thank you for having us.
Really nice to have you here. What's the story?
I'm also a local. I'm from Stillwater, New York. I'm an econ major with a minor in data science, and I also have a pre-law certificate and am currently applying to law schools across the state.
What do you think? Do you have a law school in mind? Or are you?
I have a few in mind. I'm looking at Albany Law School and applying there. I'm applying at Fordham. I'm applying at Boston College in Massachusetts as well. I'll be applying to a few more schools as well. But yeah, looking forward to hopefully attending law school next year.
Congratulations. So you're a senior?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, good. Good for you. And a law certificate gets you what? When you end, you have what?
The pre-law certificate's just like a secondary degree where you take, it's not as course, it doesn't have as heavy of a course load. So you just take some political science classes to kind of build you up for preparing you for law school.
Well, congratulations. We look forward to hearing where you eventually land. Bobby Tuig is here. And Bobby, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good.
Where's home base for you?
All the way in New Jersey, small town Ramsey.
Ramsey, New Jersey. Is that north or south?
North. I'm about 30 minutes from the city.
Okay, great. Yeah. How did you end up at Siena?
Well, that's a great question.
Oh, I'm full of them.
That's his job, is to ask great questions.
Their finance program is pretty good, so I definitely took that into consideration.
And the ultimate career goal would be?
To complete my CFA designation and maybe get into alternative investments, maybe derivatives, problem solving.
Oh, nice. Oh, that's it. Got to be proud about that. CFA stands for?
Chartered Financial Analyst.
Okay, I wouldn't have known that.
Right, yeah, no, okay. It's
that's
one,
why
of,
I asked,
one
yeah.
of the designations. Yeah.
That's great. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Delight to meet you all. Thank you very much. At any time during the proceedings, if you have anything you want to say, just raise your hand and we'll call on you. And and same goes for you, too. but we welcome your thoughts as we move throughout the morning this morning. Let's go to the big story today. And I just remember 2 weeks ago where I was saying, man, it's hard to find stories. Well, that's not a problem anymore. Yesterday, we knew this. I think we knew this one was coming, but still, it's a big one, and that is that the president-elect of the United States, Donald Trump, has named Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead HHS, which is Health and Human Services. And it is a $2 trillion, with a T, trillion-dollar agency that administers health insurance programs for millions of Americans, approves medications, and oversees vaccine safety. Fun little asterisk. RFK isn't a great fan of vaccines. But here is a guy who suspended his own bid for president in hopes of winning a spot in the Trump administration and has pledged fighting chronic disease his signature cause. The DHS is a sprawling agency responsible for administering millions of Americans' health insurance, approving drugs and medical supplies, regulating food, and responding to infectious disease outbreaks. The decision, which public health experts and many Democrats characterized as alarming and unprecedented, means that one of America's most prominent vaccine skeptics could soon oversee an agency responsible for the safety of vaccines. Kennedy did not immediately reply to request for comment on this. Kennedy, as a founder of a major anti-vaccine group, has long criticized the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's recommended list of childhood immunizations, promoting debunked claims about vaccines linked to autism. He has argued that federal agencies have not done enough research on the shots that hundreds of millions of Americans have received to protect them from measles, flu, and other infectious disease. His claims are rejected by health officials who say that vaccines have been thoroughly studied and are responsible for ending threats such as polio in the United States of America. We have nominated people for the job we disagreed with on policy and ideology, but I'm unaware of anyone who's been nominated for this job that we can't trust what they say. Those words come from George Benjamin, longtime executive director of the American Public Health Association. Mandy Cohen, the CDC's director, said she was concerned by Kennedy's selection. Cohen wrote in a text message, "I don't want to go backwards and see children or adults suffer or lose their lives to remind us that vaccines work." All right. A lot of questions here. One, of course, is just the overall pick. And then, of course, the bigger question of whether confirmation can actually happen and how that process will go. And that can be said for many of the picks, especially the more controversial ones that have come out in the past several days. March Gallagher, I'll let you start us off.
All right. Thanks, Joe. So, you know, Kennedy has said some things that are actually make sense from a public health perspective, right? He wants to eliminate pharma ads, that is medication advertisements to the public, processed food. He's saying he won't take away vaccines. But when you take that and compare it in sort of a weighted scale against the massive amounts of misinformation he's put out, it's very troubling to see his nomination move forward. And I also have to look at somebody like him with this really storied career history. I mean, this is somebody who has a long resume, and a resume that has a lot of good work on it, particularly, you know, in the middle of his career. You know, he was litigating on behalf of people right here in the Hudson Valley against, for example, GE's toxic dumping in the Hudson River. You know, he worked for Riverkeeper, he worked for NRDC. So it makes me wonder what happens to people that makes them change like this. And now I'm going to just move on to some of the really weird things he said. HIV does not result in AIDS, that COVID was sparing, you know, Jewish people and Chinese people, that the CIA was involved in the JFK assassination, you know, just things that to me sound off the wall. And then I'm going to just, you know, summarize at the end of this comment by saying this, you know, Health and Human Services has a tremendous impact on Ulster County, on the county that I'm the comptroller for. It's $25.6 million in federal expenditures that we do each year. That's HHS funds. That's federal money. And it touches things that you may not realize. It's not just sort of like vaccine programs, right? It also includes things like temporary assistance to needy families. So is Kennedy going to push back against Trump when there are, you know, cuts requested to areas that really are creating health for the population, like TANF dollars, temporary assistance for needy families? Or is he going to just toe the line? We don't know.
Malia DeMunt.
So, yes, a lot of things to be concerned about with this nomination. Hope is not a strategy, but nonetheless, I have some hope that not all is lost if the nomination goes through. Of course, that's a big question. Will the nomination be approved? It's an enormous agency with a lot to keep him busy. So unless he intends to focus 100% of his time on vaccines, you know, I don't think we're going to see, if he makes it through again, negative results in that area right away. He did say in his last big speech before he gave up his presidential campaign, he does have some things in mind, some priorities that I think a lot of us can be on board with. He's really concerned, and this ties to what March was talking about with his background as an environmental lawyer, his concerns about environmental health. And the effect of pollutants. And he's done a lot of work in that area and says he wants to continue advocating for you know, removing pollutants and understanding the effect of those.
So let me just counter by saying I agree with you, and that is a bright spot. But how does that counter with, say, Lee Zeldin as the head of the EPA?
Oh, right. Yes. So that's a very good question. How are these two going to balance out? That's a big question. Now, Lee Zeldin, the EPA is much smaller and less influential than HHS. I mean, they I think,
or even Department of Interior, whatever.
And so the amount of resources that Kennedy will have at his disposal if he becomes the secretary is going to dwarf anything that we see from the EPA.
Aaron.
When Trump was first elected in 2016, the first thing I did was watch season one of The Apprentice to get a sense of who he was and what his persona is. So this seems like season 16 of The Apprentice, where he's making unqualified people jump through enormous hoops in the hopes of gaining a little bit of his, to get on his good side. That's fine for a reality TV show. It's a very different thing when you're talking about running a government that controls a $30 trillion economy. So
it's just not as entertaining when it's not Cyndi Lauper.
Yeah, exactly. or Omarosa. So, but all kidding aside, as Marge pointed out, there are some interesting positives about RFK, about how he wants to end the revolving door and corporate representation amongst Big Pharma as, you know, major... part of the regulatory agency that governs this. It's not that he's off the wall in all of the areas, but in terms of what he's likely to do in terms of actual health policy, it seems like the writing's kind of on the wall. And economists have a term for when people who are appointed to regulatory positions that are part of the industry that's being regulated. They call it regulatory capture. This seems to be, so that would be like nominating like Jamie Dimon to be the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, the CEO of JPMorgan Chase. So this seems to be different. This is like functional capture, where you're nominating somebody who has no experience to pretty much wreck the organization, run it into the ground, and then reshape it in a way that will make it fundamentally and functionally different. And the cruel irony here is that people like RFK and then, Matt Gaetz and all of these other cabinet appointees are going to use their position, if they're confirmed by the Senate, to further their own self-interest and not necessarily protect the public good. So the cruel irony is that these appointments, and if they get confirmed, are going to probably wreak the most havoc amongst the people who ended up voting for Trump.
As far as the economy goes, what impact could this have when you have, as March said, so much money coming into municipalities and throughout the country?
It's not a mystery that Trump wants to cut funding for social services to fund, to use that money for border security and tax cuts. So the implications for this are that, HHS oversees Medicare and Medicaid. So those are two major spending programs that provide health care for low-income individuals and the elderly. The implications of this could be dramatic in terms of it forces people to pay more money out of pocket for health insurance, because if you're defunding government health organizations, then that's the way people get it. The economics of this, it's going to just place a greater financial burden and tighten the vise on the people who are most vulnerable and least able to afford, health care and medical services.
I just wonder how many Scaramucci's, RFK is going to last. And what I mean is, if you remember, Anthony Scaramucci went into the first Trump administration for a very short period of time, 3 days or maybe it was 5 days. I don't remember. But RFK disagrees with Trump on a number of issues, including
abortion.
Exactly. And I think it would be very hard to argue that you're protecting the health of Americans while you take away, subsidies for basic, health insurance. So, Medicare, Medicaid are under the Health and Human Services Department, as is a lot of other social services funding. And I just wonder if he's going to push back and how he would justify going along with the gutting of these programs while saying he's still for, making America healthy again. That's his new mantra. So I just don't know how long he'll be there. That's a question that I have.
I think we have that question with many of these nominees, right? Yeah, go ahead.
I think there's another issue here in that, say what you want about Trump, he is a pretty shrewd negotiator. And I'm not saying that ironically. These are his starting positions. So you nominate people that are just off the wall. They're, loyalists for all intents and purposes. Trump's not an idiot, and I'm sure he's getting advice that these people might not get confirmed by the Senate. So if they don't get confirmed, anybody he nominates again is going to appear sane and competent. So this is just his starting position. If they get confirmed, great, he wins. If they don't get confirmed, I'm sure his team of advisors have second and third candidates in mind that could be perhaps, more mainstream, but do as much damage as some of these other people could do.
So one more question that I'm going to ask, because I've been asking this all week, so let me ask it again, which is the you all know this by heart now. As I start to say it, your lips will move because you know what I'm going to say. But what we've heard all week from the administration is, well, the president has a mandate, and he has the right to have the cabinet that he wants.
There's a reason that we have Senate confirmation, right? And that is that these candidates for these appointments need to be able to get through the gauntlet and face the questioning. And now you have a president who's saying he wants recess appointments.
Right.
That is the power to make the appointments when the Senate is not there.
Send them away for 2 weeks. We'll put everybody in, and then you all come back. And
so my question is this Republican Senate going to just cave in to this request, which would indicate that we have lost all checks and balances? Or are those voices in the Senate that are expressing that they want to do some questioning, are they going to prevail?
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Our roundtable panel for this Friday, the 15th of November, will continue after this short break. Well, good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Malia Dumont, March Gallagher, and Aaron Pasitti all with us. We also have four wonderful students from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge Course, Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, Bobby Tuhig, and Ethan Tate. And in fact, Ethan, I know you wanted to jump in on the Kennedy nomination.
Yeah, sure. I think what's just interesting to me watching all of this is it seems like we've kind of entered into a political climate in recent years where things are so polarized on either side that we've kind of lost merit-based appointments to history, it feels like. And so it feels like all these appointments are coming in a time where the party is just using it as a tool for the party's goals rather than that merit-based appointment. And I think that can be seen across multiple agencies. And so it's disappointing to see it even in this case.
I mean, I know, you try to be careful and not to be overtly political when you talk about these things. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right. There was a time when you picked people who were, I don't know, qualified for the jobs, and you would think, oh well, maybe they did this and they did that, but they also have this policy and they have that policy, and this is, you know, and instead of just a direct anti, and certainly both March and Malia did underline and underscore some of the positive things that RFK Jr. has done throughout his career. However, for this job, you do wonder, and also, and then it goes down the line to Matt Gaetz and others who have been named. So, yeah, it's a great point of people who actually, you know, going out and finding the best and the brightest to come in. Let's go to a couple of letters. Holly writes to us and says, "Friends, these nominees are across the board ridiculous. And I believe Trump knows this. I suggest turning the analysis around and seeing these nominations as a cynical and thinly veiled loyalty test." It's just basically what Ethan was just saying. "Will he make note of Republicans who object and set his attack dogs on them?" I will say, in the days immediately following some of the more controversial nominations, that I was surprised that a lot of the press coverage was on the Republicans who spoke out as opposed to the Democrats. Yeah, this is a loyalty test, right?
But Republicans have spoken out against Trump before, and then a couple days later, a couple weeks later, immediately fall in line, yeah, and, you know, kiss the ring.
Right.
Well, I think the listener makes a very good point, I'm an analyst. I can't help getting into sort of the details, but you step back for a moment and you think, yeah, that's what he's trying to achieve here. I think it's pretty clear.
"Does anyone," asks Robert, "consider that just maybe Matt Gaetz and RFK are nothing more than a smokescreen for the Trump transition team? It wouldn't be the first time." To which I would say, let us talk about Secretary Ben Carson and Secretary Betsy DeVos, ...
It probably is a smokescreen. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I kind of look at the whole process and Trump's philosophy here as people call it percussive maintenance. Do you guys know what that is? That's when you start hitting a mechanical device that isn't working, and sometimes it works better. It's also called mechanical agitation or destructive repair. I mean, there are a lot of people in the country right now who believe that we need to break things to fix them, and that's a very scary thing.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, another way of looking at that, I mean, I've been breaking things over the last week, but not for that reason, just over, you know, concern. Let's go to this letter from Ted. RFK was running for POTUS a few months ago and having a sexting affair with the journalist Olivia Nuzzi. I believe I'm saying that correct. Who was covering him as a subject. He's disqualified from holding a cabinet position. Well,
on what basis?
I mean, he was having an affair over text. I don't know that that's necessarily...
disqualifying. It doesn't reflect positively for the journalist. Yeah, right.
Was for the journalist. They lost their job. But
we have higher standards for journalists than we do for the president or his cabinet.
I want to go back to the smokescreen argument because I don't think that's the case. I think he has made it Trump 1.0, was, you know, he appointed Rex Tillerson and some people, you know, Steve Mnuchin as the Secretary of the Treasury. These were pretty standard Republican bearers of economic and foreign policy. And, you know, with few exceptions, you know, none of them went the entire term. Jeff Sessions, you name it. He's learned his lesson from that. I think he's very serious. I don't think this is a smokescreen. I think this is what he wants to do. And he hasn't minced words about breaking things and then reassembling them in his own vision about what he thinks the country should be and what it should do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, his team has been, they've basically been preparing for this for the past 4 years. The number and the speed with which these appointments have been coming out, I mean, it's night and day from last time.
Yeah.
When it took forever and even like halfway through his administration, major posts remained empty. This time they have been preparing. They are ready. And they have an agenda that they want to unfold and get moving on immediately.
So I think the smokescreen, honestly, is to cover up the fact that this is completely Russian interference and that Trump is being driven by interference from Russia. And I'm not a foreign policy expert, but I'm just saying, when you take the incoming president's wife and you display naked pictures of her on state television and then you put your people out to say he owes us, it sends a message, right? And I think that's what's really happening here, and that these outrageous appointments are taking away from our ability to really see that there are foreign policy interests driving a lot of what's happening right now.
But with that said, I don't believe, I understand what you're saying, and it could very well be true, but I also believe that minus that Russian interference, we very likely could have had the nomination of Matt Gaetz or RFK. I mean, I don't think it takes that, right?
Okay, I agree with you there, Joe.
Yeah. So here's my favorite story about RFK. And by the way, it's hard to beat the brain worm. I'm just saying. Mm-hmm. But this is my favorite. So while he was running for president, they were asking him. He was doing an interview with, I believe, The New Yorker. I could be wrong on that. But he was doing an interview, and they were asking him what his qualifications were in talking about vaccines and science when it comes to vaccines. And he cited an article that he wrote in 2005. It's called Deadly Immunity, that he wrote for Rolling Stone magazine. And he said during that time, in writing that article about vaccines causing autism, that he started to take this deep dive and became a quote-unquote expert on the situation. Fun little note on that is that the article had to be retracted from from Rolling Stone magazine because of what they refer to as junk science. And there was another article, I believe it was in Slate or Salon, and I think it was Salon, that those articles also, that article was pulled. And so I do think that's interesting, too, that your main, like the thing you're putting on your resume is because you did a report on this subject, and then you find out but it was actually pulled because it wasn't accurate.
Are we going to use the scientific method going forward, right? Create a hypothesis and then test it, or are we just going to, you know, do something else? I mean, that's...
We're just going to try it out.
He's describing his own sort of intellectual awakening on this as a qualification. And his intellectual awakening clearly was full of problems. But that's, you know, becoming aware of conspiracy theories is not a qualification. We're buying into them.
And I mean, I know this probably doesn't need to be said, but I'll say it anyway. But, you know, and maybe this is completely unfair, but I'm guessing the article probably wouldn't have been published in Rolling Stone if he wasn't a Kennedy.
I was going to say that, but then I decided to zip it.
Not just a Kennedy, but yeah, I mean, he does have these environmental, like serious
he
environmental
credentials. He has credentials.
Yeah, but still, I mean, they're fact checkers. They're people who... that's their full-time job is to do fact-checking before something's published. So I don't understand how some of these things would, I mean, except that he's a Kennedy, that would tip the editor's decision in one direction?
Well, tip it in the sense of that it's a name that people know, yeah. and it's something that'll sell magazines.
And I mean, Rolling Stone is a great magazine, but known for its science, it ain't, you know.
Yes, I mean, they do have great scientists and people who do, but yes, yeah. you're right. Cheryl says, let's not forget the American people who voted for Trump did not elect a quote-unquote qualified person as their president. Point taken. Then we go to Ted. RFK Jr. was running. I already read that. I apologize for the repetition. Susan said the point was raised this morning. What if the purpose of these controversial picks is not to strengthen the departments but to ruin them? Does that suggestion have merit?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's the goal.
Of course,
that's the agenda.
By the way, I mean, not to be a smart aleck about this, but here's how I know that. He told us, like, I mean, I know there's a lying potential there, but that's what he said. I want to take these departments and destroy them. That was what has mm-hmm. been the message for the last, well, 4 years, but certainly in the last 2 years during the active campaign.
Didn't RFK say that he wanted to fire 600 people at NIH?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think they have plans to gut all of these agencies based on, you know, tying back to Project 2025 and also Bannon's whole plan in Trump 1, right? So.
Yeah. He is, again, as Joe said, he's made this very clear that people like, even during his first term with Sonny Perdue being the Secretary of Agriculture, you have these people who either have vested interests in the industries that they're supposed to be regulating. So it's either politics as self-interested and a profit-making opportunity, or you have people that are in there to destroy it so that it gives rise to what, and I don't use this term lightly, like a new world order in terms of how the United States engages with its own citizens and how it engages with the rest of the world.
So we have a couple of minutes before the top of the hour. The other nomination that is getting the most ink, I would say, in an old metaphor in the sense of the press, is the Matt Gaetz nomination and the DOJ, which Matt Gaetz seeks to lead, dropped an investigation last year, but the House Ethics Committee was set to release a report on Friday about Matt Gaetz and his and the allegations of having sex with a minor in these drug-fueled parties, and that he was engaging in sexual misconduct with a 17-year-old and violating sex trafficking laws. So the way you cure that, if you are a member of Congress and there's an ethics investigation, you leave Congress.
So he left the term that he's in right now.
Yes.
He resigned from the term
he's in right now.
He's going to be sworn in again in January. That's a different term, and he didn't resign from that term yet. So he could come back next January easily, and I think that's been overlooked by a lot of people, that he's really resigning from the term that he's currently in. I had to look him up. I was like, is he a lawyer even? But he is.
Yeah, but my understanding is, too, that then this would buy time in the sense that he wouldn't be out of a job if he is not confirmed as Attorney General.
He could come back.
Correct.
As Congress.
Yes.
Congressperson. Yeah.
After the Justice Department dropped its investigation into those explosive allegations in 2023, the House Ethics Committee restarted its probe into Gaetz. Gaetz's resignation from the House on Wednesday means the committee no longer has jurisdiction over him, but the panel is under increasing pressure to release its findings, including from an attorney representing the woman who has been at the center of the claims. The woman has never been publicly identified, but her lawyer said in a post on X that Gaetz's nomination is a perverse development in a truly dark series of events. We would support the House Ethics Committee immediately releasing their report. She was a high school student. There were witnesses. The attorney did not respond to a request for more comment on that. Gates said in a statement that it is a false smear following a three-year criminal investigation, and it should be viewed with great skepticism, which is what he's been saying on the matter for many, many months. Here again, that brings us back to the question of confirmation.
I don't think it's going to bar his confirmation. I hate to say it. I mean, and you look at his history in Florida. You know, he was a House member in the House of Representatives in Florida. He really championed the Stand Your Ground law. He voted against an anti-revenge porn bill in Florida. He comes from a political family. His father was a state senator in Florida. His grandfather was a mayor in North Dakota, and also was a candidate for lieutenant governor and died at the state convention in North Dakota. So he has a political history. I don't think he's going to be barred from taking the position. I have a fear that Senate will just roll over on this.
I mean, the one thing that's interesting about him is that a lot of people don't like him for what he did to Kevin McCarthy, the Republican, the Speaker of the House. And both in the Senate and in Congress. This gets back to Aaron's point of, but then do people just fold on that, or do they actually say, no, this is the kind of person we want in the
job? It's not just a matter of policy. It's people being afraid for their lives. And that's, you know, a different standard now that senators are facing when they buck a confirmation.
And I also think that senators, even those Republicans who might find all of these appointments ridiculous, they're not going to want to vote no on every single one of them, even if they don't agree with all of them. And so they're going to be picking and choosing which ones to vote no on. And Matt Gaetz, as objectionable as he might be, maybe is less objectionable than some of the others. And so he might skate through for that reason. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say he hasn't been convicted of a crime. You know, it's like the investigation was dropped. They didn't find... They didn't find credible witnesses, I guess. It's very possible this guy could end up in this position.
I mean, the only thing I would slightly push back on is the fact of, I mean, he does seem to have risen to the top as far as the most controversial.
I actually disagree with that. I think Tulsi Gabbard is much more controversial in my view. And now people understand less about what that job entails,
yes.
And it's much more behind the scenes. But I think she is much more controversial.
All right. Well, we'll talk about all of that when we come back. We'll also talk about the economy and inflation. And we'll hear from our students as well, who are joining us this morning. We welcome you to share what's on your mind, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And March Gallagher, Malia Dumont, and Aaron Pacitti, wonderful students from Siena College, will be back with us. First, we're going to take a news break. With the the yawning, is the show that bad, right? Is that what I've done? I looked up and I was like, oh, that's probably what most of the audience is doing right now. We'll be back right after this. Well, we're having fun here in the studio. I hope you are as well. We are talking about all of the issues of the day on the roundtable panel. We welcome you back to the proceedings. I'm Joe Donahue. March Gallagher is here. Malia Dumont. Aaron Pacitti, as well as four of Aaron's star students. We welcome Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, Ethan Tate, and Bobby Tuhig. And it's wonderful to have you all here on this Friday morning, and we thank you very much. So I'm just gonna zip around a little bit. I do want to talk about two economic issues, and then if we have time, I would like to go back to both Tulsi Gabbard, and I would like to go back to the Pete Hegseth, also that nominee, that nomination, which are also indeed problematic and controversial. So we'll talk about that in just a moment. So let us begin with the inflation report and U.S. inflation ticking up to 2.6% in October as the Fed considers a rate cut. Inflation has cooled notably, but a pickup in annual price increases underscores that it is not fully back to normal. So, Aaron, it's up, but it's not bad, but it's good, and it could be considered. And so what does this mean for the waning days of the Biden administration and the beginning of the incoming Trump administration?
Inflation has been probably the biggest economic issue since 2020, even more so than when unemployment shot up to around 15% in the spring of 2020. So inflation ticked up a little bit. It's down from its peak of 9.1% in the summer of 2022, but it's kind of stayed stuck at that, you know, mid 2.5% range for the past couple months. And the Fed has lowered rates to try thinking that the fight on inflation is over. There's a lot of inertia. So that, you know, when the Fed raised interest rates in 22 and 23, that those rate hikes, which are designed to slow the economy, are still working their way through the system. So there's a lot of reason to believe that inflation will continue to tick down for the next, you know, 6 to 12 months, even if the Fed continues to lower interest rates. The Fed's already lowered interest rates by 0.75%. And the goal is to, you know, keep the economy humming and to prevent a recession. The Fed doesn't want to overshoot. But the bigger problem is that, you know, when you talk about the Federal Reserve's 2% target, they're talking about a rate of change from 1 year to the next. And what that ignores is the level of prices. So since 2020, prices for all goods and services have gone up about 22%. And that was a major factor in Biden and Biden slash Harris not being able to reclaim the White House. I also think that no matter who was in office, they wouldn't have survived the inflationary period. There's no president in modern U.S. history that survived even a modest amount of inflation. Nixon resigned for a variety of reasons. Part of that was his botched effort at price controls to contain inflation. I think that just added fuel to the fire with Watergate and Vietnam. But Gerald Ford didn't get reelected. Jimmy Carter didn't get reelected. And now Joe Biden slash Kamala Harris did not get reelected or elected in Harris's case. So inflation's a problem. Inflation doesn't seem to be a major concern now. I think it drove out a lot of voters to the polls saying, hey, we don't like the way Biden's handled the economy, even though the inflation was primarily driven by COVID-related anomalies. You just had unexpected increases in housing prices, which is about 40% of all inflation. The war in Ukraine and the grain shortage that produced raised grocery prices. The list could go on and on and on. But the bigger issue that I want to focus on isn't so much the actual inflation report and whether, you know, it's going to go up a little bit or go down a little bit, is that the economy that Trump is inheriting this time around is very different than the economy that he inherited in 2016 when he was riding the tail end of a very long and strong expansion with a lot of momentum. He is inheriting a much fragile, much more volatile economy this time around. And the risk is that a lot of his policies, the thing, even though if you go to his website, he doesn't have a platform, they're just concepts of a platform. His deportation, his mass deportation, if that goes through in any context, what that's going to effectively do is reduce labor supply in two very critical industries where we've experienced inflation over the past 4 years, and that is agriculture. A lot of agricultural firms rely on undocumented immigrants. And construction, where you see, again, the presence of a large percentage of undocumented immigrants. So If people think food prices and housing prices are high now, if Trump continues with his deportations, those jobs aren't going to be filled by American workers. It's not a, well, they're gone, all of these jobs are available. These are unpleasant jobs that should be paid a living wage, but agricultural firms won't, and construction firms won't do that because it'll eat into their profits. The bottom line is there'll be a labor shortage, it'll drive wages up, and that'll drive your grocery bill up even further and put affordable housing even further out of reach. And that's just the deportations. When you think about his tariffs, which are across-the-board tariffs of, I don't know, somewhere between 10 and 50%, depending on the day and what mood he's in, and a much higher percentage on Chinese tariffs, a tariff is a tax on imported goods. So those get passed on to consumers. Those tariffs will increase the price of imported goods. So whether it's things like like clothing that's made abroad. The bigger issue is people are focusing too much on consumer goods that are being subject to tariffs. There are other goods, like businesses that rely on raw materials, like Chinese-made steel. So even goods that are made in the USA require a large amount of inputs and raw materials that are made abroad. Those goods will be subject to tariffs that'll raise the prices for domestic-made goods. And countries are going to retaliate. Nobody's going to just say, oh, well, the U.S. wants to impose tariffs, so that's fine. Usually tariffs beget more tariffs, and you have the beginning of a trade war, which will make U.S. exports more expensive and will slow economic growth. So it's a nasty combination of rising prices and slowing growth. He wants to increase spending on border security and make his tax cuts permanent. That'll drive up the government budget deficit, which tends to increase interest rates, particularly treasury bill rates, which determine interest rates on a lot of other consumer borrowing, like mortgages, auto loans, student loans, and so on. So if the Federal Reserve, getting back to Fed policy, sees a world in which inflation is going to tick back up because the fight against inflation isn't over, in combination with slower growth, it's very possible that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates to put a lid on inflation, and that's going to lead to a very large and very public clash between Donald Trump and his appointee to be the chair of the Federal Reserve, who he appointed in 2018, and Biden reappointed in 2022, Jerome Powell. The president cannot fire a Federal Reserve chair because they disagree about policy. Fed chairs can only be fired for cause. So insider training, conflicts of interest, malfeasance, mismanagement of the economy, and so on. Powell's done none of that. Powell's been remarkably transparent and, you know, towing the Fed line that our decisions are independent of politics. So if this does come to a head and Trump is emboldened to try to fire Powell, I think you will see the beginning of what would be a very quick domino effect that would likely trigger an international financial crisis, because it would send equity prices tanking, it would send bond rates skyrocketing, that would dry up credit, and maybe not as big as the financial crisis we had in 2008, but firing the Fed chair would be a step too far. It's never happened since the Federal Reserve Act was passed in 1913. So Trump's inheriting a fragile economy. All of his policies are unambiguously inflationary, and the response to that is going to be higher inflation, slower growth, and higher interest rates. And he's really, the match hasn't been thrown, but he's kind of gathering the kindling that if this does come to pass, that I think the next 4 years are going to impose more pain on the people who voted him in, and possibly lead to a period of rising inflation and a recession. And if that happens, it's going to get ugly because he will start getting desperate.
March.
So I need to take issue with the ag profits as the underpinning of low labor costs there. I'm not saying it's not true, but the farmers I know in New York State are struggling with how much they can charge for a product, and what they pay in wages is influencing that product price. So I just want to say that, because I know there are listeners out there who are trying to make a living farming in New York State. Powell says that there, you know, is nothing in the Fed model right now that takes these Trump policies into consideration. And that scared the heck out of me. And it made me think, you know, they're not taking potential tariffs into account. And I wondered, you know, if that means that this next rate cut that we're all anticipating by the end of the year is still going to happen, or are they going to rethink that? And then also on the Federal Reserve Act of 1930, you know, it was an act of Congress that was signed into law. And Trump can turn around and ask for a change to that that would allow him to terminate. I agree with Aaron's perspective that it would just create such an economic nightmare globally, and hopefully that will keep things in check. But I don't doubt that Trump will seek authority to terminate Powell. Yeah.
Students, you're going to inherit this economy and this inflationary period, perhaps. What do you make of this news?
I think there's been a lot said about kind of the dark side of what tariffs can maybe do for our economy. And while I agree that there's definitely a lot of short-term inflation that's definitely going to be in a result of if those policies go into effect, I also kind of want to talk about the perspective of what is the long-term effects of tariffs. And we've seen we're in a world now where it's increasingly fluctuating. There's worldwide conflicts, and there's an argument to be made that putting tariffs into place, except for the case of some raw materials, will push a lot of production back to the United States, which in the long run, even if we experience short-term inflation, may be able to make it so in the future we are less susceptible to kind of offshore inflation and events that cause inflation, like the war we've seen in Russia and Ukraine and the war we've seen in the Middle East.
Right.
I also think there's something to be said about the fact that a lot of Trump's campaign was based on bringing prices down to what they were prior to COVID. And I think that a large population of people who voted for him, I mean, definitely this was ideal. I think a lot of consumers feel slighted over the price increases that we have seen over the past few years. And that this promise that Trump was sort of parading during his campaign time, it sounds very ideal for them. And I think that's why a lot of them decided to vote for him. But I think that his policies just speak otherwise, because the amount of inflation that these policies will create, if they do end up becoming implemented, will do the complete opposite. And it seems hypocritical. So I'm almost wondering if this is something that needs to happen for that population to understand what Trump's agenda is and how this is really going to affect them.
Casey Owens, and before that, Ethan Tate. Anyone else would like to? Yes.
I recently read an article in the Wall Street Journal about small towns in Pennsylvania in the Appalachian Mountains that chop down trees for a living are actually just getting really hurt from these tariffs. And so if China will bite back and add on more tariffs, we actually export a lot of lumber out to China. And so one thing leads to another. These small towns that are fueled by lumber, they're going to see jobs just disappear. And along with that, a lot of the towns, because that's just what their economy is based off of. So it's definitely scary.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd just like to note, going back to what Ethan was saying about trying to offshore global inflation and stuff like that, there are a lot of products that cannot be made in the United States, and the tariffs are just kind of deteriorating those. Like coffees or different type of energy products, and I think that's important as well.
Jade, thank you very much. Got a letter from Bob who says, we understand that tariffs require the American company that is importing goods to pay the U.S. Treasury. Is it possible that Trump could set up tariffs that, in a novel approach, require the exporting country to pay the U.S. Treasury?
Like Mexico's going to pay for the wall.
That's it.
No, he can say that China should pay for part of it, but no, taxes get passed on to the consumer. That's how it works. There's no legal mechanism he can take to do that.
The one of the articles that I sent out to our group, and this is what, for those of you who are not familiar with the process or are new to the show, typically I'll go through stories and then send out some things that I see in the news, and they're just a starting place. It's just so we're all on the same page and we have the similar information, then everybody brings their own expertise to it. But there was this article that I thought was really interesting from the Washington Post that is let's look at a family picnic to see how Trump's policies could affect prices for you. And first of all, I can't tell you the last time I went on a family picnic, but I understand the analogy. And so in this, they have a picture of a family at a lovely overlook, and it says that Americans import about $3 trillion worth of goods every year. When these goods reach U.S. ports, they often face a tax paid to Customs and Border Protection that's called a tariff, a tax on an imported good. So in this picture, they have a picture of coffee, and it's from Peru, and it says 0%. Cheese from France, 10%. A basket, 0% from Guatemala. A picnic basket from China, 8%. And a music speaker, 2%. From Japan. So, first of all, I want to ask, why are those numbers so radically different? Number one. Number two, what is it about the election results that could have consequences on how much the prices we pay for that picnic change?
So, good question. The amount of tariffs by country varies, largely depending on diplomatic relations, quid pro quo agreements we have with other countries. So like Jade mentioned, for goods that we can't produce domestically or goods that we choose not to produce domestically, imposing a tariff like coffee, for example, imposing a tariff on that just raises the prices for U.S. consumers. And Trump's proposed an across-the-board tariff. Some tariffs exist because we're trying to protect infant industries in the U.S., and like Ethan pointed out, that's good policy in the long run. But what needs to happen is that needs to be supplemented with corporate subsidies to accelerate the development of supply chains, the development of industries. And that's exactly what the CHIPS Act tried to do with semiconductor production. So tariffs only work to spur domestic production if they are accompanied by subsidies and some type of industrial or economic policy that can grow U.S. industries at the same time. So the reason tariffs differ, back to your original question, they could be very varied. It could depend on international relations. It could depend on whether we can produce the good at home. But what Trump's proposing is an across-the-board tariff and then special tariffs on goods that are made in China. It's a zero-sum game for him. If some other country is winning, we have to be losing.
So 10% or more on all imports and a 60% tariff on all goods from China. Mm-hmm. And this obviously would raise the cost for imports.
Right.
But where you just talked about this, but where I don't quite understand it, so they have it here that the speaker system that we used to say was $100 will now be about $110. Okay. So, but is that really enough to drive an entire industry to start to produce that item in the United States of America?
Probably not. I mean, you would have to have punitive tariffs coupled with very generous subsidies to really switch the production calculation. It's the Council of Economic Advisors for Biden estimated that the average effect of the Trump tariff plan, which is 10% across the board and then 60% or whatever on China, again, it varies by the day, will cost the average American family about $4,000 to $6,000 a year in higher prices. That's substantial. So if you think about it, you know, the median household income in the U.S. is $8,000. That is a 5% increase in their cost of living just because of the tariffs.
And in this article, they say it could be as high as $2,500.
That's lower than what.
That's
Aaron
lower.
Said.
So one think tank estimated a version of Trump's plan would cost a middle class American family more than $2,600 a year.
It could be as high as $5,000 or $6,000.
Right, $5,000 or $6,000.
He doesn't have numbers that stay consistent. Right.
So
right?
That's the point being.
So yes, it's some of the
all
model.
Yes, but the point being that's an expensive picnic.
It's a very. It's going to become a more expensive picnic. It's going to become more expensive to buy. You know, imported clothes. It's going to become more expensive to buy cars because a lot of those raw materials and parts come from Germany and Japan. They will be subject to tax. It'll be more expensive to buy smartphones because they're manufactured in China. Most of the parts come from a variety of first world countries that'll be subject to taxes.
But in addition to the effect on consumers, structurally, it actually makes American companies less competitive over time. Right. I mean, so when you have an infant industry, put a tariff in place and with subsidies, you can help grow that. But in order to help that industry really take off and be competitive internationally, you have to remove those helps. And so they can sort of make it on their own in a way. Right. So I think that's another long term effect from widespread tariff use. And I also just want to point out that this is a power that didn't always belong to the president. In the Constitution, Congress has the power to implement tariffs. And Congress over time has given a lot of that power away to the president. I don't know what the likelihood is that some of that could be clawed back, but it's brought us to the situation here.
So I know America is going to be first, but if other countries, wouldn't they respond by raising their tariffs?
Yeah,
we saw that with China the last Trump administration.
Yeah, no, that's what a trade war is. It's a tit for tat. And the risk is that, you know, a lot of industries that were supportive of Trump, like agriculture,
right,
who rely a lot on export markets for things like soybeans and other, you know, inputs to other types of food production, they're going to be hit hard by those tariffs. And again, the irony is that the policies that got Trump elected are the policies that are going to hurt his voting base the hardest.
Got a minute, March.
Yeah, I was really interested in manufacturing jobs, and I went this morning to look at Bureau of Labor Statistics just to see, you know, in December of 2020, we had 12.2 million manufacturing jobs in the United States. How have the tariffs affected that? Did we reshore, you know, the CHIPS Act? In August of 24, we had 12.9 million jobs. So that is a 700,000 person delta, and that's almost a 6% increase in the number of manufacturing jobs. I notice in my own county, we're holding steady at 3,400 manufacturing jobs from month to month and year to year. So I do think there has been some improvement in manufacturing because of the changes in CHIPS and other tariffs.
We'll wrap up this conversation when we return, and we still welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. First, we have this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 15th day of November. And we welcome you. We have a great conversation underway and invite you to it. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Malia DeMont is here. March Gallagher, Aaron Pasitti, and four of Aaron's students. So we're all economics majors from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge Course, Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, Bobby Tuhig, and Ethan Tate. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let's move on to other topics. As I said, we would talk about tariffs and the inflation and then get back to some of the other issues when it comes to the nominations and the nominating process. We spoke at the top of the hour about some of the more, I said that I thought Gates was one of perhaps the most controversial choice, And Malia said, I would say Tulsi Gabbard, and I certainly understand that. So let's talk a little bit about the Gabbard appointment, as well as, and I will tell you that when we were talking about Pete Hegseth on this program, and your colleague and friend Fred Hoff said, oh, I wish Malia were here. I'd love to, to hear what she has to say about this.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
All right. Well, let me start with the former then.
Yes.
Tulsi Gabbard. Now, like me, she is she's a lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, and in fact, we belonged to the same unit for a while. I never met her. We weren't ever in the same place at the same time, but she is assigned to the 351st Civil Affairs Command in Mountain View, California. As far as I've been able to determine, she is not and has never been an intelligence officer, has never received any intelligence training. I believe she has at least one deployment to Iraq. She was with the medical unit, and now she's with the civil affairs unit. And so it's just not clear to me what her that tricky word, qualifications,
yes,
are. Also, she doesn't show, even aside from not having any background in a field that is very technical, requires a lot of training, she doesn't seem to have an analytical mindset, as evidenced by the sort of opinions she comes out with, which don't seem to be based in fact. So I just want to quote Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, who is a former CIA case officer. I believe she's the only one serving in Congress now who used to work in the CIA. She says she's appalled at Trump's decision. Not only is she ill-prepared and unqualified, but she traffics in conspiracy theories and cozies up to dictators like Bashar al-Assad and Vladimir Putin. As a member of the House Intelligence Committee, I'm deeply concerned about what this nomination portends for our national security. And so you could say, all right, Matt Gaetz is similarly offensive or unprepared. But the difference, I think, with Tulsi Gabbard is if she makes it into this post, she will oversee a vast, vast bureaucracy with an incredibly high budget, much bigger than what Matt Gaetz would control. And much of it, for good reasons, not transparent. Right. So the ability of the American people to engage in the checks and balances that they can in a more direct way with someone like, you know, Matt Gaetz or Department of Justice is circumscribed a lot when you're talking about the intelligence community. 18 different intelligence agencies. And then, you know, given some of the public statements she's made about Putin, about North Korea, about Syria, it just, I think, would. There are a lot of international implications for this as well. I mean, we have very advanced intelligence capabilities, but we also rely a lot on the intelligence sharing agreements we have with allies. And, you know, that's backed up by a longstanding history and the treaties we have and all that. But it's also backed up by trust that we're going to do the right thing with the information we get. And I don't see Tulsi Gabbard in her own personal history coming to logical conclusions with the information that she has at her disposal. And so I just am very, very concerned about what she would do at the helm of this very large, very consequential part of the American government.
I'm assuming that there were, even in the Trump orbit, that there are people, maybe I'm wrong on this, but you would consider to be qualified for the job.
I mean, I don't have a list in my head. Nobody comes immediately to mind. But I wasn't aware of any scuttlebutt of, you know, who was in the discussion for, you know, who might take on this role. I never thought I would find myself quoting John Bolton, but John Bolton even said on NPR earlier this morning that both these candidates, Matt Gaetz and Tulsi Gabbard, don't have the competence or the character to carry out these positions.
Yeah. John Bolton has been very outspoken in the last several weeks, throughout the campaign. Pete Hegseth.
So Pete, I you know, I don't own a television, so I haven't seen Fox News or any of the other news. But so I had to Google him.
Oh, it's really good.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, this is what this is kind of like. You know, my first thought was this is what central casting. What, you know, this is when Hollywood thinks, what does a Secretary of Defense looks like? It's sort of like this chiseled guy who has a good, you know, good photogenic nature on television.
Great tattoos. A lot of crucifixes.
Right. So aside from whatever that is all about.
Aaron, I'm not dissing tattoos.
No, I know. I understand that.
Yeah. Go ahead. He doesn't. There's just I don't even know where to start. No experience running any kind of bureaucracy, but that's obviously not what Trump is looking for. Except right. I thought there might be a little bit of a difference in the case of the Defense Department, because that is arguably the part of the government that Trump is most likely to support and maybe even increase funding for. He wants to use the military for all kinds of things that I don't think are constitutional. And as an officer in the Army, it's my job to determine which of the orders are given to me are lawful or unlawful. And that's a huge burden for any individual. But I don't think I've ever encountered an unlawful order in my career, and I hope I don't anytime soon. But, you know, he would not have it's a natural conclusion to come to that when Trump says things that he's going to use the military to clean up the streets or that his Secretary of Defense pick wants to follow through on those policies. And there are a lot of constitutional issues there, obviously, in addition to just Hegseth. I keep saying his name wrong.
Pete Hegseth.
Hegseth.
Rolls off the tongue.
Yeah. There's a lot of talk about Trump wanting to clean house in the Pentagon. Now, certainly the ranks of generals, we could probably survive with a few fewer generals. There are almost 1,000 generals in the entire U.S. military. Do we need all of them? Probably not. But the way that he intends as far as we know, he intends to go about clearing house, again, doesn't conform to any process that has been set up to manage these things. So I'm just really concerned about what this leadership means for the profession of arms. It is a profession. And anyone who has visited a class at West Point knows that ethics are part of what you study. And speaking of Marist, where I'm going to go to this basketball game tonight, they've got a ROTC unit there, an Army ROTC unit. Anyone who has been through ROTC or any, like, ethics is part and parcel of what you practice and what you study when you join the military, and especially when you become an officer. And I see a lot of ethical challenges in our future under under these nominees.
We have about 5 minutes left. I don't want to. I'm not looking to out any student here for any reason. But from a show of hands, how many of you voted in the election last week? Okay, and it's the majority. And I'm curious as to and anyone who wants to talk about this, but where? How do you make it? I realize most of you are any of you over 20 years old? Okay, two, and then 18, 19, right? So my question, and the reason I ask that is because of like how many voting cycles you would have had, but also you have this. Some of the issues that we've been seeing following the first Trump election. I mean, you were 8 or 9 years old when all of that was going on. I'm just wondering. You don't. We can all look and say, oh, well, this never happened back in our day. You know, we had Iran-Contra. We didn't have this. And it's different. And I'm just wondering of how, for want of a better term, hopeful you are for the the future and what you see as we've just finished this election cycle?
I think there's things about the current state of the government and the state of the United States that are certainly concerning as a voter, but I think ultimately I feel a lot of trust towards the American political system and the checks and balances that are within it. Even in a situation that we're in right now, that the kind of just American way will prevail. And there certainly is, I think, concerns about my financial future as it comes to inflation and all of these things. But I think as things like the economy can fluctuate, we're set up in such a way that even if there's moments where it feels like things are going downhill, I think ultimately I feel like things will stabilize. And as a voter, that made me hopeful and made me not like interested and invested in the outcome of an election, but not seeing as at the end all be all for the future of the United States.
But you have a certain amount of trust in the systems that are in place that they can bring you personally to a situation of being able to start your life and in a way in which you want to.
Yes, absolutely. And that's not to say it won't get harder or easier depending on the current situation or who's in office.
Oh, man, it's clear sailing from here.
Yes.
Anyone else want to? Yeah.
I'm just looking forward to a time in my life where an election debate actually progresses what we need as Americans instead of just name-calling. And I'm hoping that in the next election, we can actually reach that point. I mean, I know J.D. Vance is likely going to try and run after the Trump term.
Yeah.
And I just hope that there can be some return to normality.
I would just to finish on that thought, as a 20-year-old female, especially voting in this election, I think that there was a lot of controversy and a lot of very harsh thoughts on either side. But I am also a patriot, and I really do believe that, you know, that our country was built on the idea of freedom and democracy for everybody, not just for some. So I, like Ethan, I do agree that our country will be able to pull through, and there are still people out there who remember those roots.
Well, it's delightful to hear you say those words. Anybody else want to say anything else? All right. Yeah, go ahead.
I would just like to add that I don't think that there's really a state of, like, normalcy. I think that all countries have their ups and downs, and I think that we're just at a down point right now.
I mean, that's a great point. I mean, normal is, if this is what we got, then this is normal, right? If this is what it's been like for the last 10 years, then I guess that's normal. That's a great point. Well, I wish you all the luck in the world as you go forth and try to right the wrongs of our past. We welcome and have been thrilled to have Casey Owens, Jade O'Connell, Ethan Tate, and Bobby Tuig with us. They are all economics majors from Siena College's Federal Reserve Challenge Course. Thanks to Dr. Aaron Pasitti for bringing them in, and always a pleasure to have you. You'll bring more students back?
Oh, yeah, there's still a parade coming over the next 3 weeks.
I love a parade. Malia DeMont, go Army!
Go Army!
Have a great game. Thank you very much for being with us. March, thank you as always. I appreciate your insights. We'll be back right after this.